streetlights around me. In the wall-to-wall prison of my city, flickering dirty neon over alleys mean and dirty streets.
Hello everybody from that nightclub at the end of the world. This is Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth, back with you on the 22nd of December in the year 2013. It is the day after winter solstice, and I participated in a little ceremony last night. It's a very sacred time for me, marking the time when time stops, when the sun's progression southward through the skyline stops and it begins moving back northward, and the days, instead of becoming ever shorter, become longer every day. And boy, we're looking forward to that. It's cold here in Crestone. So and there was a great present last night. Doug Lewis, my bandmate, and Squishy the dog came home, and it was a surprise. Circumstances worked out in Northern Cal, where Doug said he was absolutely miserable living in that world of endless shopping centers and so far away from this little remote, tough, challenging, but wonderfully clean wilderness here. And he and Squishy came back, and it was a great surprise. I didn't know what was happening until sometime during the day yesterday. Rags and Squishy are united again. Doug is back, and so there's a little joy that came with the darkest night, the longest night. I got to change a couple things because the board operator's got to come back because I got to play something for you. But that's okay. We can do this. Let us do some updates on Fukushima, and Guy McPherson is standing by, but I need to update on this, and we've been so busy with Fukushima over the last weeks that we haven't caught up on climate collapse, chaos, all the FUBAR stuff that's going on, but we will. But some updates on Fukushima. Hattrick Penry did a great thing. He's still on the job doing very well. I'm glad I had him on the show. I'm glad he's still doing it. He has Fukushima Fact versus Fiction Plumegate Update 12/21. 13, which you can find on his website. It's on YouTube, and it's and linked to from hattrickpenry.wordpress. But he went through the FOIA docs and looking for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages information relevant to the USS Ronald Reagan, and we've all been tracking, you know, a class action suit filed on behalf of 70-some sailors was dismissed, but there are a lot of really sick young men and women off the Reagan who were needlessly exposed to, I'm sure, what is going to prove fatal radiation, which is, again, consistent with the fact that I believe that four spent fuel pools are gone, but there's some other damning information. New records this week on radiation levels at Reactor 2 and at Fukushima. All of this from Energy News, EENE News. You find it all on my Facebook page. It's there. People are becoming aware. Nobody's trying to peddle the moving the fuel rod stories anymore. We need to kill that. Good. But an E&E story showed, well, one, that radiation levels may be, this is a story from today or yesterday, may be 1,000% of the levels previously reported by the government and TEPCO. Glad this stuff is getting out. But there was also an E&E news story today, which was that radioactive water was found deep beneath the core of Unit 4. We have been told that the core was empty. It does not appear that that is the case either. There has been some, this corresponds very strongly to a video that is up on my Facebook page right now, indicating that not only was the cap off, which means anything that melted and vented directly atmospherically, was not contained vertically, but that there was actually fuel in the core open that melted down. And this story from fukuleaks.org, fukuleaks.org, radioactive water found deep beneath Unit 4 with photographs extremely well documented, shows that 82 feet below the bottom of the containment vessel is extremely highly radioactive water. What if that was the big secret everybody was trying to keep? Which was that, there was fuel in 4, that it did melt down and the cap was off and that vented directly into the atmosphere. We're seeing lots of anecdotal but increasing amounts of anecdotal evidence, which we look forward to having discussing thoroughly on the show with Mimi Gurman as soon as the Radcast map is up. What an amazing outfit and bunch they are. We can't wait to do that. But the evidence is building, and it's being gathered in a reliable way, showing that, yeah, all that radiation is out and is already taking a huge bite out of the health of everything that it comes in touch with, and that would now include all the Northern Hemisphere. Those are the Fukushima updates. Woohoo. Whew. Okay. I want to play a clip, a very short clip for you, which is a trailer for a Vice special. I told you that Vice was out here filming back in October. We did 7 or 8 very intensive days, and I gave him my heart. And it's called Apocalypse, comma, Man. Not Apocalypse Man like Repo Man, but Apocalypse Man, or Apocalypse Earth, or Apocalypse, you get it. I wish you could see this, but you can if you go to my Facebook page. It's right underneath the post I did for this show tonight. The videography, the photography, nobody does visuals anywhere like Vice, whether it's the magazine, their photographs, or the stuff they shoot. And this trailer is pretty captivating. It's going to air. It's actually going to premiere, I'm told, on the Internet. Free from the grips of Time Warner, free from the clutches of GE or Viacom or anybody who owns those mainstream outlets. And it's going to premiere. It's 90 minutes in the middle of January. And I very much likened this, and it had the great feel of the work that I did with Chris Smith on the documentary Collapse. The director here is Andy Capper, and he is an incredibly talented guy. And I've had a very good feel working with him and the great crew that was out here. And this is, people have been, you know, saying, well, God, you made a lot of money. You don't need to ask. No, I have no financial interest in this at all. I did not get paid. I have no back end on this or anything else. I didn't do this for money. I did this film for the same reason that I did Collapse. I did it for everything that wants to live. Pretty much everything wants to live except for all the things that want to die and that seem to be in control right now. But I'm going to play this for you. It's only about 23 seconds. There's a little dead spot for sound. Oh, but by the way, you'll also hear me and see me singing live in the video in this. And they gave me a credit in the soundtrack or score. Maybe I can join a union or something. Anyway, it's about 23 seconds. But in this, in the dead spot that you hear with the music, ask yourself a question. What would you do if you were the last human on Earth? And how would you know? Okay, here's the trailer. Let's roll this in, then we'll get to Guy.
Is being destroyed all around us. Using money to try to address that problem, it's shooting yourself in the foot. Evolve or perish, grow up or die. An entirely new level of human consciousness is needed right now, or we're all dead. Mankind openly descends into a world of bloodshed without end. Dog eat dog until everything is killed and the last man commits suicide or is poisoned, having all the toys and they mean nothing. When you believe you're already dead and you got nothing to live for, you fight better than you've ever fought in your life. When your back's to the wall, that's the only time when humans actually choose to evolve, at the moment of death, at the moment when we face our destruction. That's when the greatest leaps in human consciousness and the leaps of human heart take place. I'm tired. I'm ready to die. Great, bring it on. I'm not afraid of death at all. That'll be a big relief for me. That'll be graduation. God, I get out of this godforsaken shithole. that I love more than anything else in the world. The scout's knife is sharp on both edges. It cuts in both directions.
Apocalypse, Man. Apocalypse Man. From Vice TV on the net. You can I'm sure you can find it. I'm sure that they'll be telling everybody about it. We'll be out in January. I have not seen it. I don't know what's in it. I saw the trailer and I was very impressed. But this is not a deal where I'm afraid of some corporation or somebody trying to make me look good or make me look bad. That's not the way it works. Film is an art. And I learned this, and I enjoyed this lesson deeply with Chris Smith, who did such a great job in Collapse. And I said this to Chris Smith. I said, Chris, I don't care what you make me out to be, and nor am I trying to tell you what to make me out to be. All I am asking is that you have the honor to convey your vision in the film. And so there, it is a pure human exchange between two artists, me and Andy Capper, and Vice, and you know everybody who made it possible. And I'm not worried about it, and I will look forward to see what his vision was. At the same time, you all do middle January. Okay, let's get on with the show. All right, enough of that stuff. That is kind of exciting, though. It really is. All right, comment of the week. This is before I bring in Guy. Mimi Gurman, who I can't wait to get that woman on the show. I know she's listening tonight. You better hear that. I'm going to send Luigi Guido and Salvatore, my thugs, to come get you in Portland and put you on the show, okay? You got to get that map up. She wrote a comment. The woman guest following her interview, this was Mimi on Nuclear Hot Seat with Libby Halevi, not Helen Calicott, talks about how she listened to our interview and thinks that she has the flu with a shot of Fukushima mixed in. Hey, that's no joke anymore. How does radiation affect you? This is a really good question to think about. It's a bit of a road from rads to sickness to cancer to death, depending upon your location and your immune system. And boy, is that sinking in. I've seen enormous examples of sharing and caring on my Facebook page from friends and people who are posting, you know, three women on my block came down with breast cancer within the last 3 months. I know that that's something. And somebody else reported that their wife had developed symptoms of thyroid cancer. And these little anecdotes are coming up. But so what's happening is that people are starting to share their experience. And I am seeing such enormous love and caring flowing in both directions as the heroes stand up and give us warning of what we are beginning to perceive, whether from whatever the cause, radiation or climate collapse, is the fact that this is real. This is really real. Guy McPherson's been on the show a whole bunch of times. He's professor emeritus, you know, University of Arizona, natural resources, ecology, and evolutionary biology. Everybody know, I'm not going to waste the time. He's Guy McPherson. His latest book is Going Dark. He has been and he has become something it's a heavy word, icon, but he is iconic in that. He's recognized everywhere, not for his resume now, but for the message he carries. And people have been listening. I've seen pieces on him in The Nation magazine. He's been on with Abby, the wonderful Abby Martin on RT. And people are listening, and I'm not seeing, at least in print or the interviews, a lot of derision. Guy, you're out there on the front lines. First of all, tell us how the heck you are and how you're doing, and then talk to us about the exposure you've been getting lately.
Well, thanks for having me on the show again, Mike. I appreciate it. I got looking around today and realized it was 3 months to the day since I've been on the show, and in that time we've triggered five more enforcing feedback loops. We're up to 30 now.
Yeah.
I appreciate the exposure I've had as a result of Dar Jamal writing for Tom Dispatch and then for Abby Martin at RT.
Yeah.
They're catching on. They're really getting it. Dar contacted me about a month ago and said, I can't believe I haven't heard of you before. I just came across you and your message, and this is going to be form a primary basis for my work from now on. And he did tell me that he heard my name listening to you. So I thought that was quite an endorsement of you and your show as well.
We are the best leaderless cabal and conspiracy ever. It might have to do with like a change in consciousness, which maybe we're going to talk about. Before we play the first song, take a couple of minutes and update us on the status of the climate, the ecosystem right now. I mean, everybody's experiencing utterly bizarre weather. They're wearing shorts in Siberia, you know, and it's frozen down here and all that. So how bad has it gotten?
Well, the methane situation is completely exploding. It's pretty clear at this point that we have fired the class rate gun that climate scientists have been worried about for a long time. Based just on that single self-reinforcing feedback loop, that's out of 30, global average temperature is expected to rise as much as 4.5°C by 2030 and 10°C by 2039. That's based on Sam Moran's research. Those are huge numbers. Remember, we've never had human beings on this planet when it was 3.5°C above baseline. So 4.5°C, 10°C, that could be problematic for human animals. Given
what about this? I heard discuss the possibility of a huge methane burp. Is that looming, or has that happened, and what would its implications be?
Well, we can expect up to a 50 billion ton burst of methane that would warm the Earth by about 1.3°C. Such a burst of methane is highly possible at any time, according to Natalia Shakova's work, and that's a quote from her. Highly possible at any time. Nobody is saying that burst has occurred yet, but the methane bubbling from the seafloor of the Arctic already has produced sufficient forcing to prevent sea ice from forming in the area. That's as of a week ago today. And so the methane is bubbling out of the Arctic at an astonishing rate. It's finally starting to attract some serious attention. People are writing about it increasingly, and it's making it into many different outlets at this point. So it's a big deal. Nobody is saying that the methane burst is upon us, that 50 gigaton burst is or burp is upon us yet. But it might well be underway. If not, it seems quite likely to occur in the not too distant future.
How long would it take for us to realize that it had occurred? And I know the answer. What would the effects be?
Well, I don't know how long it would take for us to realize it has occurred. Paul Beckwith is probably a good person to ask that question, or maybe Sam Karana. Paul Beckwith did a little video just a couple of days ago and concluded we could experience up to 16°C warming within a decade or so as a result strictly of methane being released from the Arctic Ocean. Again, that's just one of the 30 self-reinforcing feedback loops. The consequences? Game over for humans. We run out of habitat, I would say, very shortly thereafter.
Very shortly, in geologic terms or calendar terms?
Human terms. Almost certainly in the neighborhood of half a decade or so.
Wow. Okay. All right. So there's...
I mean, if we get to 2°C, it's not long to a much bigger number after that, and because of these self-reinforcing feedback loops. And methane, in the short term, meaning less than 20 years, it's something like 100 times more powerful a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, molecule for molecule.
Right.
So this is a big, big deal. And of course, the information is just starting to get out in places like the Guardian and from the Referee Journal literature. but it certainly hasn't attracted the attention of the mainstream media in the United States yet.
Yeah, but people are noticing the weather. That's just like we not hearing much of anything about the Dog and Pony Show about the fuel pool and Reactor 4 anymore, and yet people are becoming much more cognizant of radiation effects right where they live. You know, we're seeing now, due to this emerging network, you know, readings that Lakewood, Colorado this week got hammered over 111 CPM. This week, 100 is an alert. But, you know, the awareness is coming with the illnesses, so people may not be accepting climate change, but they certainly are getting that the weather is changing. And maybe through that avenue comes awareness. And let's do a song. I've picked a couple of songs, but, Guy, this particular song was so appropriate because whether we look at it from the standpoint of global warming or from the standpoint of radiation, the world is on fire, and it's more than I can handle. I'll tap into the water, and I'll try to bring my share. I'll try to bring more than I can handle. Bring it to the table. Bring what I am able. And this is kind of a theme you were talking about. Here is Sarah McLachlan, World on Fire.
Doesn't mean much. It doesn't mean.
Okay, welcome back. I want to thank everybody for coming. Thanks, Sarah McLachlan, for being here. And one more time, ladies and gentlemen, Sarah McLachlan.
Is on fire. It's to the water. I'll try to bring my share. Try to bring more than I can handle. Bring it to the table. Bring what I am able.
Well, that kind of hit the nail, I think, right on the head. Pretty good. Got another cool song later. But now, Guy, when I watched you with Abby Martin, I was really pleased with that. And you were sharp there. You ended with a great statement, which I firmly agree with, which will help humanity to define what it is as it leaves, speaking in Terrence McKenna's term, the material plane here. You said something like, it may be too late for us, but it's probably a good idea if we tried to do something to save everything else and let that live. Go into that more deeply and tell me if you've had any resonant feedback from that from anywhere.
Well, I haven't. We're pretty self-absorbed creatures, after all. And David Ehrenfeld, conservation biologist, wrote a book many years ago called The Arrogance of Humanism, in which he describes how even the human beings who don't consider themselves religious in any way are plagued by humanism, by this arrogance that we are the all-important, most important individuals on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, you know, I'm a conservation biologist, and I have been for a long time. And I've recognized for a long time that we are a species, in many ways, like every other species to ever occupy the planetary stage. We have some advantages, some distinctive characteristics relative to other species. We have sentience, for example. We are clever, perhaps even too clever by half. But in many ways, we are like every other species as well. I want to read something to you because I've been reading a book by Michael Carter called Kingfisher's Song. It came out about a year ago. The subtitle is Memories Against Civilization. And Carter writes something that resonates with me. He writes, "Power isn't all-powerful. It gets politically and physically beaten every day. Its infrastructure is often exposed. They can't guard every mile of pipeline or power line or every ship in every port. They just can't. Is it enough to withdraw, to try to be a good person with good relationships, to hope for the best, to hope we escape the worst effects of a dissolving society and environment? Or is it better to fight? I think it's better to fight. Not for fighting's sake, but for life and decency, for honor and dignity. And to win." And what Michael Carter is talking about in this book is the same thing that I was talking about when I was speaking with Abby Martin, and that's winning on behalf of a living planet, even if it means we're not on it, if we're not part of that living planet.
Mm-hmm.
To retain habitat for other species seems like the least we can do, given that because of industrial civilization, we're driving 200 species a day to extinction all by our lonesome.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's time we turn that around.
This is Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth. We're at the bottom of the hour, just doing a station ID here. We're going to roll without commercial interruption tonight here on PRN-FM. This is the Lifeboat Hour. We're with Guy McPherson. Guy, that's deeply... It reaches and it triggers something, and I was so glad to hear you say that. We're still, and I think we're close to turning a corner collectively in having human beings actually understand that this is it. And certainly, as you have said so eloquently, between climate collapse and the need to shut down 450 nuclear reactors and the fact that industrial civilization has to go, and we are in, it's like a catch-22 cubed situation. with that, where these compounding factors are working, and it's pretty clear that we're done within a very short period of time. You've been carrying that message. I talked about at the beginning of the show, or just before I introduced you, I said, was talking about these people starting to share the experiences of cancers in their families and their lives all over the country, and they're seeming very peaceful about this. Has the level of attacks on you diminished any, or are you getting more messages indicating that people are aware? And if so, what are those messages telling you?
Well, it's quite varied, as you might expect. The number of messages in my email inbox is ratcheting up considerably. But I get messages like this one that I received just tonight. Subject line, what do I tell my son? My 48-year-old son has broken down numerous times in the last week since reading and listening to your material. He is a single father and needs to hold up. What can you say to him? And, you know, that's tough because I'm trying to present information, and with respect to climate change information, it's just information based on data collected by other people and presented by other people. And I'm just trying to connect a few dots here and make people aware of the current and near future situation. That's a tough pill for some people to swallow.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, I open myself up to people and I offer to chat with them via Skype or on the telephone, or if we're nearby, to meet in person. But I'm not a psychologist. You know, I can't provide the kind of professional help that a psychiatrist or a psychologist can, so I'm not exactly sure what to do with people who despair as a result of the message that I'm bringing forward.
One of the lessons that I have learned through my long walk has been that what people have always responded to most with me was my humanity, was me being able and willing to be transparent, to put my heart out. And you've been putting your humanity out. And it occurs to me that perhaps since we're imprisoned in Cartesian, Newtonian, ridiculous tyranny, especially the tyranny of a corrupt science, you know, that humanity is a way of cutting out all of those middlemen, a heart-to-heart communication. And I would just offer that I think it's your heart that's winning as many people as your mind or your arguments.
Well, yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I know I'm landing some pretty serious blows when, for example, I had to switch the server on my website because the issues with that were growing so severe.
Yes.
That I had to rely on an IT team of volunteers, fortunately, who are providing a gift to me by making sure NatureBat's list stays up and active.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of that, as well as frequent messages threatening to sue me and do me bodily harm, that indicate that people are actually starting to catch on.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be harder and harder not to catch on as the weather gets screwier and screwier and more people start showing cancer all over the place, which is happening. I mean, I guess it's kind of an academic question, kind of useless. I wonder at what point, you know, the scales will finally tip, how much it will take. What do you think?
Well, right. I mean, it's one person at a time, and that's pretty slow going when there's no leadership on the issue. You know, there's no leadership from the corporate media or from the corporate governments of the world, so that means individuals have to figure out.
I would submit there is leadership, Guy. You're it.
Okay.
Whether you like it or not.
I appreciate that, but I don't have the mouthpiece of empires, including the New York Times and the Washington Post, at my disposal.
Well, you know, I'm seeing things change more quickly than ever. I do agree with Terrence McKenna that time is speeding up, which is a whole separate discussion we should have sometime over dinner. You know, I was talking to Carolyn Baker this week, and I thought, geez, I'd like to do a workshop with Carolyn Baker. And I thought, no, the ideal would be to do a weekend workshop with you and Carolyn Baker and me and see what we draw to that. I don't know how we do that or how that would materialize, but there's a great synergy. Of course, Carolyn is helping people to approach, and she's got another new book. She's so prolific, it's ridiculous, and I love it. But people are paying attention, and I'm getting the sense of a snowball rolling down the hill. What's coming for you? Do you have anything pending? Any major events pending? Anything like that?
I have a few events coming up. A few of them are still in the planning stages. Presentations in Austin, a speaking tour in the Pacific Northwest, helping with a two-week-long seminar in Guatemala, both in March and June, a one-week version of that seminar in Belize in May. So things are heating up for me on those fronts. Somebody has asked me to write a revised version of Walking Away from Empire, updating it and cleaning it up a bit. So I have a lot on my plate. It's not like I don't have plenty of things going on.
How's the homestead? How are your goats?
So that's all good, and the goats are all good, and the homestead is keeping me busy, of course. So, you know, there's the challenge of having a foot in each of two worlds, the industrial, civilized world that allows me to have conversations such as with this one, which I love, and to travel around and present dire information, which I also love, even if the audiences don't necessarily appreciate it as much as I do. And then there's the post-industrial world that I've been working on and toward for the last 6 or 7 years on the homestead. And so that's a lot going on. There's another film being made about me and my work.
Good. Same filmmakers? Or?
No, Pauline Schneider out of Westchester County, New York. And if you go to my website, Nature Backlash, just click on the latest post there, and you'll see a trailer down the page a little bit that she's put together.
What's it called?
I don't believe it has a title at this point.
Okay.
If it does, I don't know the title, but for her, the message in the film Michael Soseby put out was a mixed message, and that's understandable because I sort of switched messages right in the middle of the two-year project of him making the film.
Yeah, we all did.
Right. And so the message was no longer about collapse. It was about, not about economic collapse, that is, but about climate collapse and the collapse of habitat for human beings. And so that's going to be Pauline's focus in this film, is we don't have forever. How do we act if we know we have a finite time on the planet?
I noticed that Abby Martin, was trying to elicit something, and you stuck to your guns. You didn't lie, which is a true sign of honor, and I love the way you handled that. But you must get asked, 1,000 billion times every time you speak, what do we do? From the world of human doings, who need to learn how to be human beings instead of human doings. What's your stock answer, or do you have one when somebody says, what do we do?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, people want to go down the hope road, and so I frequently cite Nietzsche, hope in reality is the worst of evils, for it extends the torments of man, and presumably woman, too. He was sort of a misogynist, so he wasn't willing to go there. I quote Edward Abbey, action is the antidote to despair. So if you're damned if you do and damned if you don't, then do. Let's do something. And in particular, let's work for a better future, even if we don't have one. Let's work for a better future for those many, many, many species we're driving to extinction on a regular. And here a phrase from Desmond Tutu comes to mind, of all people. If you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor. And too many of us, for too long, have been neutral in situations of injustice with respect to the living planet. If we're going to have a living planet beyond our time on the stage, then we've got to get with the program and start shutting down those nuclear power plants and acting as if the living planet matters.
one of the things that I start to prime myself with mentally before I do this show every week is I sit down and I repeat a little litany to myself, and it varies from week to week, but you know, there are still tens of thousands of coal-fired plants operating right now. There's tens of thousands of natural gas-generating plants that are using fracked gas to generate electricity. We're still doing tar sands. We're still running a billion internal combustion-powered vehicles. The industrial machine is still cranking it out. And Fukushima appears to be spewing out more radiation all the time on top of the two or three times we've already been told we've had. All of that has never diminished, and it's never stopped. And those are, as Derek Jensen would say, those are the things that are killing you when you're out trying to compost in your yard and buying a Prius. You never bothered to stop industrial civilization. All those things are still underway. And, you know, every time I think about that, especially when I'm talking to you, it makes me pay more attention to the conversation you and I are having.
Well, that's right. The industrial machine just keeps going on and on and ratcheting up and getting worse every year. You can, carbon dioxide emissions increase every year, and they've been doing that for at least the last 6 years. Each year increasing over the previous record-setting year. And so, yes, we have nuclear power plants, and coal-fired power plants, and the horrors of empire that surround us. And so I frequently, of course, hear things like, well, you're guilty too. Well, yeah, of course. But to focus on that guilt, to focus on that shame, is to take the approach of turning the oppressed into the oppressor. It's taking the victim and making them responsible.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't build this society. I was born into this society. Like everybody else, I was born into captivity. We don't have long left. Let's be compassionate. Let's be kind to one another. And let's extend that one another to non-human species as well.
Well, you just set up the second song perfectly, Guy. I want to thank my dear friend Grandma Coco, who everybody knows on Facebook, and she's just a wonderful, wonderful woman, spiritual friend. I love you. Kiss the Grandma Coco. The song is by Rod McDonald, a very accomplished musician, an amazing singer. The song is called Every Living Thing. So here's the second song for tonight, then we'll come back, finish out the show with Guy McPherson.
Seems like there ought to be a way to look each other in the eye, to see we're all in this together, and put all thoughts of victory aside. Seems like there ought to be a way to turn some fear into trust, no matter what you say. There has to be a way, every living thing is counting on us. Seems like there ought to be a way to separate the freedom from the flesh, to see what's real in the illusion. Sometimes a beauty walks around in red. Seems like there ought to be agreement. We would rather live in peace than fight. No matter what you say, there has to be a way. seems like this ship out on the ocean must fly on the wing of the dove. No matter what you say, there has to be a way.
That was Rod McDonald. Song is Every Living Thing. You can find that on YouTube. Rod McDonald. Great singer. What a great voice. Okay, Guy, I want you to correct me if I'm wrong here. This is what I've pieced together, and you tell me where I got it wrong. The jet stream is highly erratic. We're seeing enormous weather impacts from that all over the world, Great Britain, here in the States, all over the world, in Siberia, et cetera, et cetera. And as I look at the jet stream, it appears to be becoming much more erratic and unpredictable. But my head went a step further and said, wait a minute, that energy or that erraticism, I guess that's a good word, is going to have to dissipate down into a kind of stasis to the point where everything is just hot. Am I getting that or what?
Well, in the near term, I don't know for how long, nobody knows for how long, but in the near term, this meandering, oscillating jet stream is going to make for hot and cold in places where, and at times where it's not supposed to be hot and cold. So there's so much that's so unpredictable, especially in the short term. In the long term, we know where this is headed. We've already fired the phosphate gun. We know that in the not so distant future, there won't be habitat for human animals on the planet anymore. Well, how do we get from here to there at any particular spot on the globe? I don't know, I'd be skeptical of anybody who says they do know.
Okay. Perhaps wishful thinking, because what we desire as human beings is we want to have some predictability in a world in which predictability is an absolute thing of the past. I loved your line that the imminent future is not going to be anything like the recent past. Will there come a point perhaps where it just starts getting hotter and hotter and hotter everywhere progressively, and we all can see that with our eyes?
Well, again, I don't really know.
Okay.
Because of that meandering jet stream, because of the slowing and potential reversal of the thermohaline conveyor belt, which is going to make things, at least in northern Europe, extremely cold and wet in the short term. So it's hard to say at what point it becomes so hot that it becomes unbearable for human beings. Whether we run out of habitat for humans before that occurs remains to be seen. I don't think that we're all going to die because we can't handle 35 degrees centigrade wet bulb temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's the case at all, because we're never going to get close to that before we run out of habitat for humans in New Zealand, for example, and southern Australia. So I don't think it's going to get so hot. It's just the global average temperature is going to get so hot, and it's going to destroy the ability to grow plants and therefore food.
Okay. So I guess I can infer from that that we can just count on more unpredictability, more erratic behavior, and we need to be on our toes.
Yes, absolutely. I just don't see any way around that in the time we have left. I just don't see us being able to predict, even in the relatively near term, what's going to happen with the climate.
Another question, which is kind of ancillary to this, but it's very closely related, it would be the issue of environmental refugees on a large scale. Have you given that any thought, and what the implications of that might be?
I know a lot of people who have written about that, and I haven't given it a great deal of thought, in large part because I remain optimistic about the termination of the industrial machine. And so when that stops, people are not going to be traveling 100 miles, much less 1,000 miles, to get from one place to a more northern climate or a more southern-like climate, depending on which hemisphere they're in.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't given that a great deal of thought. Perhaps that's I'm barking up the wrong tree there, or perhaps it's just because I'm narcissistic enough to not be concerned about that for myself.
Well, you know, I'll speak for myself. I'm going to be 63 on February 3rd. And, you know, I'm not moving anymore. I'm not running anymore. There's no place to run. And this is the message I've been trying to convey for a long time. And as soon as we realize that our backs are against the wall and we stop trying to run, then perhaps wider openings will become available to us. Let me observe this. We're down to the last 8 minutes. We got plenty of time. Let me observe this, is that I am sensing an increase in momentum on our side, in terms of people becoming aware of the fact that we are absolutely facing near-term extinction, and this is for real, and this is not a game. Has your message changed at all recently, and do you see your message evolving, and if so, in what direction?
Yes, my message has changed considerably just over the course of the last few months. When I started about a year and a half ago talking and writing about near-term human extinction, I was still almost strictly in my scientist's left brain. I was pretty heartless about the whole thing. I was just relaying the facts. Just the facts, ma'am. That sort of thing. And it never really occurred to me that other people might not handle that message well, when I was presenting it in such a straightforward, unspirited manner. And so certainly, as I speak to more people and I get feedback from those people, I'm trying to actually live my message, which is people with compassion, including when I speak and when I write.
Mm-hmm.
And so my message has changed and will continue to change, and I continue to look for ways to make this message palatable to tap into the wisdom of the ancients, for example, as well as contemporary people, and try to figure out how we tap into the idea that it's not just us as individuals. Of course, we all know that we're going to die as individuals. We reach that realization when we're relatively young. But what about beyond that? What about for the whole species? What about everybody we know and everybody we don't know? So it's a constantly evolving message on my part to try to increasingly accommodate the notion of compassion and kindness and living as though the day were here. I'm processing this too, and I don't have any education or training as a therapist or a counselor. I am just a simple scientist, as they say, and so I'm trying to process this and present it in a way that's palatable, and it's proving to be quite the challenge. And so my message is changing all the time, and I hope it's getting better and is starting to reach people in a meaningful way.
Okay. Well, you know, that's what we're all trying to do, and of course I do it every week with this show, but what I'm sensing is there's a little more wind at my back now, at our backs, and we need that wind because we are truly it is a race against time, which we know is running out, but what if we don't know the exact minute. But I think the import is the awareness that makes us ask existentially who we are, what we are, why we're here, but also to ask non-existentially, as Terence McKenna would say, what our relationship is to everything that is beyond what has been available to us with human consciousness.
Absolutely. That's a great point, because we spend much of our time in this society focusing on resources and calling them resources. And I think it would be a better planet for us and other species if we instead focused on relations instead of resources. So what does it mean to call something a resource? If it's another species, if it's this living soil, if it's another human being, are they resources or are they relations? Are we supposed to have relations with these people, or are we supposed to exploit them as resources? So that's the direction I've been trying to take myself in recent months and years.
So maybe at the last minute before the click and the eschaton arrives, we will actually come to say to ourselves, "Oh my God! All the indigenous peoples had it right all along. Everything is connected." Maybe we'll have a glimpse of the web of life that we've ripped to shreds, that no longer sustains us as we fall. And who knows? I mean, as Terence McKenna might say, you know, that's when you have the fire in the madhouse is when consciousness breaks free for the stars. And I'm sure we'd all like to know what's on the other side of all this, but I think we're all going to get our answers very soon.
Yes, and it's a wonderful point. We can be happy without having a whole bunch of money, and I think people realize that at the end of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
I hope we're realizing that at the end of the line as well.
I hope we are too. That about wraps us up tonight. Guy, there's like 1 minute left. Is there anything that we didn't get to that you would like to get off your chest tonight? Anything at all?
Well, on that latter note, GDP is no measure of happiness.
Yeah.
Bhutan is the happiest nation in the world, and it's also one of the poorest. And so what can we learn from people who are living a lot closer to the planet, as you pointed out, as indigenous people have been doing for their entire existence on the planet? And I think we can learn a lot from them.
Well, may we all get to that awakening. Guy McPherson, thank you so much for coming back on the Lifeboat Hour, my friend. It is an honor and a pleasure to be on the field with you. And I'm seeing more great warriors emerge around us and a charge forming. Let's hope that we can carry that and fight the good fight to the last frickin' minute.
Thanks for the opportunity, Mike. I really appreciate being on your show.
Guy, I love you. We'll have you back soon. All right, everybody. It's Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth. Another episode under our belt, and we keep adding them on to the list. It just gets longer and longer, and let's hope we have time to work this all out before the lights go out. I'll see you next week. Day is getting longer, and hopefully awareness getting better, brighter. This is Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth. Good night.